It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strangehamps. Today, amusement parks. When I was a kid, summer break never felt complete without a trip to Fantasy Island near Niagara Falls. By today's standards, I guess it was pretty tame. I remember a wooden roller coaster called the Silver Comet, and a Ferris wheel, and my favorite, a gigantic slide as tall as a building. You climbed up to the top, and then you sat on a burlap sack, and then you slid about 50 miles an hour down. It was both terrifying and thrilling. I bet you have memories like that, too, of some wonderland full of noise and the smell of butter and pink cotton candy. Coney Island, Six Flags, Pacific Park. When you're a kid, they're all magical. But amusement parks have also shaped America in some profound ways. Historian Lauren Rabinowitz says they helped modernize the country. She tells Steve Paulson they introduced Americans to the wonders of technology.
100 years ago, you wouldn't have seen the roller coasters that we think of now when we think of an amusement park. Back then, they were scenic railways, and they only went about 20 miles an hour. The technology had not been developed yet. But you'd see a lot of different rides that would take people into darkness. And the big centerpiece of the park would actually be the Chutes ride, which is akin to what we would have as a water slide today. That was actually the fastest ride at the park and in generally the most popular.
So the impression that I'm getting is that at a place like Coney Island, just all of New York would come out to see them. I mean, this is a place people wanted to go, especially on a weekend.
Absolutely. It was the place to go, especially for the working class on weekends. And I think what most people don't realize is that there were over 1,500 parks in the United States.
Wow. So they were all over the country. They were everywhere.
They were everywhere. Any town of any size had an amusement park. Any city of any size was likely to have more than one amusement park. New York City actually had 5 amusement parks besides Coney Island. Other parks might be smaller. They might not have as many rides, but they had picnic groves. They had swimming of some kind. They all had movie theaters. They were where you went on a weekend to get out of the confines of the city.
So was this basically about having your thrill? You go to the amusement park to, I don't know, sort of get a bit of excitement, or were they more than that?
They were that, and I would say they were more than that. Certainly they represented thrill rides, as we would call them, that were about giving your body over to new kinds of technology. A lot of them depended on railroad technologies. And railroad technology was still new enough, especially in cities, that it wasn't considered 100% safe. But it was giving your body over to technology in a way that you assumed was safe and that you would be assured would not go out of control.
Weren't the railroads usually the ones who owned the various amusement parks?
Yes, about 75% of the parks were built by railroads. And they didn't really care if the parks made money. They just cared if the parks broke even, because they were really trying to encourage people to ride the railroads.
So part of this was just getting people more comfortable with riding on trains, I guess.
Yes, and providing revenue for the trains in non-peak hours.
So, I mean, partly what you're describing is it was to some degree a vision of maybe a new kind of urban life and mixed in with some new technology.
It was a vision of a new kind of urban life, but a new kind of urban life given over to pleasure. It took what was urban, and instead of having it be threatening or concerns for multiple classes and races commingling, it took all those things and put them into a pleasurable atmosphere.
So how far can we take this idea? I mean, do you think early amusement parks played a role in shaping our national identity?
Absolutely. And I think what's important is that they helped shape our national identity, not just in the major urban centers, which is often when people look back and think about America at the turn of the century, they tend to think about urbanites living in major cities and then farmers out in rural lands. But the farmers out in rural counties also had access to amusement parks in nearby cities. So amusement parks helped shape a sense of a modern sensibility, but for both the rural folk and urban folk alike.
Now, we should mention also that not everyone liked amusement parks. In fact, some people hated them, and the social reformers wanted to shut them down. You have a quote from Jane Addams who called them wretchedly inadequate and full of danger.
Well, the social reformers and certainly Christian ministers were especially worried about the dangers for young girls, that these were places where temptation provoked young girls into going to beer gardens, drinking, meeting young male strangers, and basically getting into trouble. So they thought of amusement parks as a place of ruin and as dens of vice, especially for young girls, for working-class factory girls who didn't have much money and would often go to the parks and actually get picked up and get treated to the various rides and things going on at the parks. The dance halls also encouraged young girls to dance new dances where you might be, you know, dancing rather close with somebody, rather intimately, with somebody that you hardly knew, shaking your body. And these were all things that reformers were concerned about, that young girls leaving the confines of the ghetto of the city didn't really have anywhere else to go and get fresh air or to enjoy themselves on a weekend. And so they went to the amusement park.
You know, listening to you, it sounds like the amusement parks were maybe more like the Las Vegas Strip than Disneyland.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a real apt analogy, that the Las Vegas Strip today is a kind of theme park for adults and provides all kinds of temptations and different types of entertainment, all sort of juxtaposed next to each other. Whereas Disney hated amusement parks, actually, and his goal with Disneyland was to sanitize the park and to make it a completely family-friendly enterprise.
Which is fascinating because, I mean, I guess when we think of an amusement park today, I mean, the first thing that would come to mind would be a Disney park. But you're saying in some ways this is not at all the kind of amusement park in American history.
It is part of the amusement park in American history, but from the 1950s to the present, Disney's had such a major role in shaping the amusement park. But his was a reaction to the amusement park. His was to take it and to turn it into a series, again, of shows that were not only family-friendly, but his parks referred to movies as well. So to take the park, and rather than making it an experience of encountering technology and finding pleasure and thrills, to find a kind of pleasure in entering into vicariously one's favorite movie.
So what happened to all the old kinds of amusement parks that we were talking about? You said there were 1,500 across the country.
And various things happened to them. A large number were built by private railway companies. They went out of business. They went bankrupt. Their land got sold off. And other reasons, the parks were on the edges of cities that were expanding and growing. And by the 1920s, they were no longer on the edge of the city anymore, where real estate was not worth much, but the land itself became worth developing.
And did they also suffer from a stigma? I mean, that kind of the wrong people hung out at the parks? I don't know. Were they associated with crime?
They were associated with vice more than with crime. As a matter of fact, I haven't really seen much that associates them with crime, more with sort of lower class pursuits, gambling, alcohol, indecent dancing. And reformers didn't have much luck in shutting them down. They got some parks to remove the alcohol, but not much luck in shutting them down. But parks themselves, their fates depended largely on the fates of the railroads that came to them. And a lot of those railroads shuttered in the 1920s.
So it sounds like you're describing the transition from these original amusement parks to more of the family-friendly Disney parks as kind of the shift from appealing to, I guess, what we would associate with the working class to middle-class entertainment.
I'd say that's correct. There certainly are a few parks that have survived from 100 years ago, a handful, but there aren't too many of them left. And even these parks have adapted and changed over time.
So did you grow up going to amusement parks?
Well, I did, but long after the heyday of the amusement parks of 100 years ago, I grew up where there was an amusement park, and by the time I went to it, it was sort of old and seedy. And I think the most enlightening experience for me was going to Los Angeles one summer and going both to Disneyland and to Pacific Ocean Park. And Pacific Ocean Park was one of the old-style amusement parks, and when I went, it was dirty, and it had games of chance, and sort of tattooed carnies lurking in various places. And I have to say, the sense of danger and excitement was pretty thrilling to a 14-year-old girl, you know, trying out all these thrill rides and, you know, giant roller coasters where you really went fast. And I found as a teenager going to Disneyland was too tame. It was too contained. It was too prepackaged. And I think we've lost a kind of excitement and thrill of sort of flirting with danger in a way that you don't see at amusement parks today.
Lauren Rabinowitz is the author of Electric Dreamland, Amusement Parks, Movies, and American Modernity. Steve Paulson talked with her. So I could almost see Coney Island 100 years ago during that interview. But to really bring it to life, here's writer Leslie Parry.
In its heyday, it was kind of the playground of America. This was before Disneyland, before theme parks. It gave people in the city a day's journey over into a wonderland. It was a chance for people to be kind of thrilled and frightened in a safe place, and was a place of a lot of sensory stimulation. Extraordinary circus acts and sideshows, giant theatricals, and animals the likes of which a lot of people in the city had not seen. Elephants and tigers, things we might take for granted today, but for many people it was their first experience with something so exotic. And also, it was affordable. You could take the ferry or the train over for the day. It provided people a seaside respite from the kind of drudgery, perhaps, of their workday lives.
Leslie Parry's debut novel about New York at the turn of the century includes a family of sideshow performers at Coney Island. It's called Church of Marvels. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, magician and sideshow performer Todd Robbins will share a few tricks.
I have right before me here a 60-watt GE bulb. I usually eat 100-watt bulbs, but I'm on a diet. And these are the jokes.
I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about amusement parks in this hour, and it's time for the sideshow. So I want to introduce a modern marvel, a guy named Todd Robbins. For decades, he's been dazzling audiences at Coney Island and off-Broadway with carnival acts, the old-fashioned, or maybe I should say classic kind. He swallows swords, hammers nails through his nose, eats light bulbs. In fact, get this, he says he's eaten thousands of light bulbs throughout his career. But my question is, he can't really be doing this stuff for real, can he? I mean, it's all an act, right?
Yeah, it's real. The things of the sideshow are traditionally based upon principles of physics and anatomy that make these things possible. And since most people slept through, you know, anatomy and physics classes in school, the secrets are pretty safe with performers there.
So is this stuff hard to learn how to do?
Some of it can be learned almost immediately. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a TV show, the local lead-in to the Today Show. They're coming out to Coney Island, and I will be teaching the hosts how to walk over broken bottles in their bare feet. That's one of the easier things to learn.
How do you walk over? I want to know how. Can you teach us over the
radio?
Well,
it's all based upon a couple of principles, one of which is that glass, though it is jagged and though we all have a reference point for pain with glass because chances are we've all cut our foot at one time or another, the fact is that it loses its sharp edge fairly quickly. And if you use glass from wine bottles as opposed to very thin glass of a drinking glass, for instance, it's not as sharp. Of course, as I'm saying this, I'm not trying to encourage anyone to actually go out and give this a try. This is the kind of thing you have to learn firsthand basis from someone who knows what they're doing. But if you have a pile of the right kind of glass there.
Is there any trick to breaking it or something?
No. There's a couple things that you want to get rid of. You want to get rid of the bottlenecks and the bottoms of the bottle because the bottoms of the bottle are sticking straight up. They're nice little jagged things, and their sole purpose in life, pun intended, is to cause pain to your feet if you step on them. And the bottlenecks are like when you step on them, it's like log rolling. It throws your balance off, and the balance is so very vital to work doing something like walking over a broken bottle. So what you do is I will explain to the person what they're going to be feeling. They put their foot on the glass. They get to feel what the sensation is. If there's any point that is too sharp, you move it a little bit, and it'll move off to the side. And there's enough surface area on the bottom of the feet that you can distribute the weight evenly, and there will not be enough on any single point, there will not be enough weight to actually cause a puncture.
Yeah, this sounds like one of those easier said than done kind of things.
Yes, to a certain degree. Like I say, if you were here, I'd have you, walking over broken bottles in no time.
What's the first thing you learned to do?
I learned fire eating, which is traditionally fire eating is a entry-level skill of sideshow. And even today, even though there's really only one traditional sideshow left out in Coney Island, that's really about the only thing. There is one showman by the name of Ward Hall who occasionally puts together a live show to go with his kind of oddities museum that he tours with in carnivals. But the only real permanent sideshow company is out in Coney Island. And even so, there are probably, I'd say, maybe 300 or 400 people around the country that eat fire, performers, various jugglers, street performers, things like that. Then it gets, it starts to kind of whittle itself down. There's probably, I'd say 150 or so, 100 to 150 people that do what's known as the Blockhead Act. And then from that, there's maybe 25 of us.
What's the Blockhead Act?
The Blockhead Act? I'm glad you asked. The Blockhead Act was based upon a torture stunt that was taken from the fakirs of India, from their repertoire, by a man by the name of Melvin Burkhart. And Melvin did this back in 1929. He took this stunt, and he turned it into this joyously gut-wrenching act that when Robert Ripley, of Ripley's Believe It or Not, saw him do this, he said, "Melvin, you are a human blockhead." And the act consists of, the bare bones of it are taking a very large nail and a hammer and hammering it into your nose.
Oh.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Like piercing skin?
No. Most people have a hole there. That's how you breathe. It goes right into the nostril and right back into the top of the throat. As a matter of fact, I have sitting right here in front of me Melvin Burkhart's hat. He just died back in November at the age of 94. He was one of my mentors. And I have his hat right here. I have his hammer right here. And I have some nails right here.
You're going to do this?
Sure, why not? And basically what you do is it just goes right back. It feels so good after it stops hurting, I got to tell you. It's a good way to get iron into your system, you know. And you should see the faces of the people here.
I can see the faces of the engineers here.
just hearing. And let me just pull it out here. Ah! Oh, look, my fever has gone down. How nice. So what is it? Because of the lighting in the studio here, I thought there was blood on there, but it's not. It's just like comedy.
Well, tell me about your most famous skill, the glass eating. I know you've done this on TV and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever done it on the radio?
I actually have. When I travel around, I do a lot of colleges and universities, and through the years I've done a number of kind of rock and roll clubs and comedy clubs. And invariably, every community has some sort of wild shock jock that's on the morning radio or you know, afternoon drive time. And I'll go on and do the stuff that I'm doing here, and just it actually plays very well. I mean, if Edgar Bergen could have a career on radio doing ventriloquism, you know, a guy eating glass is not that far-fetched.
Well, since this is public radio, I guess we'll do sort of a tamer version. But did you bring some glass with you that you could eat?
Why, I'm glad you asked. Yes, I have right before me here a 60-watt GE bulb. I usually eat 100-watt bulbs, but I'm on a diet. And these are the jokes. And it is a GE bulb. You know what GE stands for? Good eating. It's just like comedy. And it's a very simple little process. You know, the problem is you kind of have to take my word for it. There's, you know, I don't want anyone to give this a try. This is so dangerous. There are some people, actually, that have seen me do this on TV and have given it a try and think they know what they're doing just because they've seen me, and that is not the case whatsoever. There is a way of chewing up the glass and swallowing it so it doesn't cut up the mouth and throat, and there's a diet and regimen that I go through every day that keeps it moving through my system. Now, I learned this again from an old sideshow performer who did it for 30 years, traveling around the country. And I learned how to do this. And it's that reason, those little secrets that I know. It's no trick, really, but there are technique behind it that keeps this from cutting up my insides and allows me to take a bulb like this. And it's the real deal. And we'll do this. You ready?
Yeah.
You sitting down?
Uh-huh.
You strapped in there?
I'm a little nervous.
Well, there's no reason. You're nervous. I'm the one eating glass. I mean, let's be very honest about it. Here goes. Oh, that was a good one. Tastes like chicken. You know,
I can't believe you just did that.
You know, the sad thing about radio is you can't see people's reaction, because that's really what makes this all worthwhile, is look on people's faces. It makes the whole ordeal worth doing. Because, see, chewing up the glass and swallowing is the easy part of this stunt. It's what's coming up a couple of days from now that I'm not looking forward to.
I can't believe you did that. Didn't it hurt?
No. You mean going in?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were talking about coming
Well, coming out, too, but I assume it's not coming out yet. But
no, it's the kind of thing, like I say, I know what I'm doing here. Every once in a while, I do get a little cut on my lip or gum, you know, but, you know, if it wasn't dangerous, everyone would be doing it. And, like I say, it takes about 2 days, and one light bulb really is not a problem. Out in Coney Island, I'll do it when I'm working out there, eating glass of lead, 10 to 12 light bulbs a day. Actually, I've been doing it quite a bit lately. As a matter of fact, I've got so much glass in my system right now, I could poop a chandelier. But that's beside the point. You know, there goes the funding right there. I've got so much glass in me right now, if I pass gas, you'd hear a wind chime tinkling in the breeze. Brings new meaning to the term light at the end of the tunnel, doesn't it? But I digress.
Do you need a glass of water or something here?
Now, that's dangerous. New York City water. Now you're asking me to really risk my life. Yeah, I got water here. And I've done over 3,000 light bulbs during the course of my career. Let me just swallow it all.
You're eating a whole damn thing, aren't you?
Oh, man. Don't you hate it when you get a piece of glass stuck in your teeth? I hate that. Let me floss with the filament. Oh, by the way, I'm not going to eat the metal part. I don't do that. Because the fact is, I got to fly to Chicago. If I eat that, it'll set off the metal detector in Newark Airport. And let's face it, if you work in security, would you believe my story? No. I can almost hear the snap of the latex gloves as they prepare for a full body cavity search. Well, we've taken this into a whole new level, haven't we?
I guess I'm wondering, why do that? Why work so hard to get your body to do these incredible things?
Well, just the fact that the body is capable of doing something that extraordinary, that strange. Again, it's the kind of thing of pushing yourself and finding how far you can go with these kind of things. And I think that's kind of important. Also, there's the historical element that these things go back generations. Some go back centuries. Some have all but been forgotten. So it's carrying on that tradition. That I think that's very important also. But mostly it's just, like I say, it's just amazing what the human body can do. And that's what the sideshow has always been about, sort of exposing people to things they just didn't know could be done.
Magician and sideshow performer Todd Robbins. He's also the author of The Modern Con Man, How to Get Something for Nothing. The main attraction at any amusement park is the thrill ride, and the scarier the better. Frankly, they've gotten way too scary for me. They're drop rides that take passengers 400 feet up in the air and then drop them in gut-wrenching 90-mile-an-hour free falls. Rocket coasters blast riders into the air at 128 miles an hour. But if you're looking for a truly terrifying ride, probably doesn't get much scarier than what writer B.J. Novak imagines. Here's a bit from his debut collection of short stories called One More Thing.
The almost legendary artist Christo was on the verge of completing a dream that he had held close through his entire career: to design an American roller coaster inspired by nothing less profound than life itself. Life, the ultimate roller coaster. Today was an important one for Christo. It was the day that he and his financiers would observe the reactions of the most consequential people who would ever ride the ride, the 12 persons selected at random for a small focus group. "All right, everyone," said Tom, the focus group leader. "What did people think?" "I didn't like all the ups and downs," said one. "I wanted more ups and downs," said two. "Why did the family part at the beginning end so abruptly?" asked three. "I hated the family part," said 10. "Also, why were there two of them?" asked 4. "There was that track that took you out of the family at the beginning, and it was so exciting and sudden, but it lasted like 2 seconds and led you right to another part that ended up almost exactly the same as the first one." "It wasn't exactly the same," clarified 5, "but yeah, it had a lot of the same dynamics." "Did people like certain parts of the ride more than others?" "I thought the first half was more fun, but the second half was more interesting," said 9. "Yeah," said 12. "Somehow in the second half, it felt like I was actually driving the car I was in, even though, of course, we were just along for the ride, same as always." "What should we call this roller coaster?" asked Tom. "Life," said 2. Everyone got quiet. "Yeah, life," said 8. Christo, watching behind the glass, nodded. "Monster," said 5. "Monster?" asked the focus group leader. "Yeah, monster." "Monster sounds cool," said 4. "No," thought Christo. "Let's take a vote," said the focus group leader. "Monster it is." Christo was angry almost beyond the borders of the much surveyed powers of his own comprehension. "Monster?" He did not spend the last 19 years of his career dreaming that one day he might be remembered primarily as the designer of an amusement park roller coaster ride called Monster. But his dream was dead now, murdered by idiot whims, and there was nothing he could do about it anymore. "Oh well," thought Christo, "that's life."
And that's B.J. Novak, reading from his debut collection, One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories. Coming up, John Jeremiah Sullivan takes us along on his unforgettable trip, emphasis on trip, through Disney World. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about theme parks in this hour, and the most iconic of them all, Disney World. The Magic Kingdom can be a pretty astonishing place under normal conditions, but imagine taking the magic up just one more notch with a little help from a controlled substance. John Jeremiah Sullivan wrote an essay for the New York Times Magazine a few years ago about a pretty unusual family trip to Disney World. Sullivan, his wife MJ, and their 4-year-old daughter Mimi went to the Magic Kingdom, and they took along another family, Trevor and Shell, and their young kids, daughter Flora, and their son named Lil Dog.
When the children were huddled lumps in various spots on the sofa bed, Trevor and I stood on the balcony. He talked about how challenging it would be the next day and during the next days and nights in the park, not being able to smoke. That wasn't high on my list of concerns. In fact, I was foolish enough to think that the fact of Disney, that we would be spending our time in the heavily surveilled park, might banish the very notion of smoking weed, easing Trevor's many withdrawals, and making my life easier too, in that I wouldn't spend too much time stoned, only a few puffs at night like this. It would be a non-issue in terms of domestic harmony. Trevor wasn't trying to hear that at all. He was definitely stressed. "I'm gonna lose my mind in there," he said. "Have you ever been in there?" I had once when I was 11. I didn't remember much. It bounced off. "Well, we go every year," Trevor said, "and every year I feel like my skull's about to split open." "I always figured you were doing brownies," I said. "I do brownies," he said. "I have brownies, but you know." I did. Edibles are good, and wise heads move toward them over time to save their lungs, but there's something about the combination of oxygen deprivation and intense THC flush that comes with smoking, and in particular from smoking joints. There's no real substitute for the abuser. A brownie can alter your mood over hours, but a joint swings a psychic broom around you. It clears an instant space. "I actually saw this thing on the internet," Trevor said, "where people were talking about getting high in the park." "At Disney World?" I said, as if I hadn't been listening. He led me back inside and quietly cracked open his laptop on the kitchen counter. "Check this out," he whispered. Only the two of us were awake. I dropped into one of the swivel stools in front of the bright screen. I was reading before I knew what I was reading, but it was like a chat room, or a forum. Forum is the better term. A motif of cannabis leaves and naked women holding glittery buds ran down the left margin, a pothead forum. Trevor scrolled it down to a posting, the subject of which read, "Hello from Disney World." An anonymous person, evidently the veteran of a staggering number of weed-smoking experiences in the park, had done a solid for the community and laid out his or her knowledge in a systematic way. It was nothing less than a fiend's guide to Disney World. It pinpointed the safest places for burning the proverbial rope, telling what in particular to watch for at each spot, isolated footpaths that didn't see much traffic, conventional smoking areas with good hedge cover, places where you could hide under a bridge by a little artificial river. Those were its points of interest. The number of views suggested that the list had helped a lot of desperate people. The main point was clear and consistent. Be ready to book it. No sooner had we pressed our fingers onto the biometric scan pads, because if you can't trust Disney with your biological data, then old Trevor began to show signs. He hadn't been able to smoke that morning, quarters too cramped. He was craving. Not that he acted jumpy or cranky. I could just tell from the body language and sentence length that it was on his mind. Nothing like an enclosed space. And Disney World, for all its gigantism, manages never to let you forget for a second that you're in a very tightly enclosed space to make a head start scanning for exits. Lil Dog and the ladies were sailing by up above on the Dumbo ride in three successive elephants. Mimi had a tentatively happy face. It said, "I'm ready to think of this as fun, as long as it doesn't go any faster or higher." Trevor and I leaned on the railing like bettors at a track, smiling and waving every time they went past as if we were dolls with arms hooked to wires. Trevor had his phone out with the internet dialed up to the guide, he consulted it when they were on the dark side of their orbit. Checking it against a map of the park, we determined that one of the spots mentioned wasn't too far away. A little used maintenance pathway with trees alongside it and some dumpsters. Given a properly positioned lookout, you could have a puff in relative calm. We slipped away. Now we were truly at Disney World. A person didn't come here every day. What is the scene here? Hello, primary colors. Hello, quickly fading microdramas of passing human faces, incessantly deciding whether to make eye contact. Hello, repeating stalls and gift shops. We were walking on the balls of our feet. The surface of things had become porous and permitted of the potential for enjoyment. Where were our womenfolk and little dog? Let's find them. Let's be good fathers. Tomorrow was Father's Day. Oh my God, I didn't even remember that. We don't need to remember that, Trevor said. We are that. We are Father's Day. Next memory, riding on the mechanical boat through the It's a Small World attraction, continually spraying Mimi, who looked as if she had been boiled in a tank. Her cheeks were so red and her little forehead was glowing. The whole time I was spraying, she was waving at the dolls, acknowledging every single doll's wave with her own, showing an OCD-like desire not to miss anyone. It seemed that she misunderstood the nature of the dynamic, believed we ourselves were part of some parade being observed by the dolls. A more natural idea, I suppose. Why would you go floating by in a boat to look at children standing along the banks of a river? They would be looking at you, because you are a princess. Flora was angry because Lil Dog hogged their family sprayer and was just sitting there spray-fanning himself right in the face. And by the end of the ride, he had squirted all the water away. Son, Trevor said. No sooner did we enter Epcot than Trevor started checking his phone, and while I won't bore you with more detail about that business, there being no tediousness quite like dope or tediousness, suffice it to say that the rest of the day was spent on pendulum bouts of ecstatic, hyper-attentive parenting, followed by separation from family to indulge addiction and vice. There is deep yearning at Disney. What you feel when you're in the state we were in and all of your emotional pores are wide open is yearning. There is something at stake here for the families in terms of that knife edge between joy and disappointment. So when you see people whose kids are definitely not having fun but are standing in place and screaming, having to be dragged along by their leash harnesses, there's a throb of empathetic sadness. They are not having a good Disney. I looked at Mimi. Was she having fun? I thought so. She was smiling. But I knew there were times in my own childhood when I must have seemed to my parents like I was having a blast, while being inwardly tormented by some irrational worry. Ah, youth. How many of my genes had she inherited, and could I teach her how to play them better? You want joy for your children, but you yourself have brought them into this world of suffering. The strangest thing that happened was the very last thing that happened. As we were leaving the park on the evening of the last day, it began to rain a monsoon-like rain. You'll have to believe me when I say it was exceptionally violent. The next morning, I said to one of the bellboys at the hotel, "You guys probably get weather like that a lot, huh?" He said, "No, we don't." It was as if a black spaceship had swooped down and blocked out the sun. Sheets of wind were tearing through. Lightning continually exploded just above our heads. The tram caravan kept having to stop, which made it only scarier, as if they had driven us out into the open in some sacrificial way, as target practice for an offended storm god. Also, it was disturbing to see the clockwork perfection of the Disney machine threatened that way. It hinted at a larger underlying weakening of something. The tram we were riding in was open on the sides and covered above only by a plastic canopy. We were exposed and getting blasted. But we had the Disney ponchos. Shell had made us all buy them. At a gas station, so possibly they were knockoffs. But they worked. And by sitting close together with all of them spread, we could make a tent. It must have looked very weird. On the other hand, I'm positive that every other person on the tram wished they were under it with us, and I'm pretty sure at one point we did have some other people's kids. Underneath, in the dark, the children were loving it. Mimi and Flora screamed in terror every time the thunder boomed, but their terror was full of joy, and afterward there was laughter. And it was wonderful to be able to cover them. We had the solution for this, barring a direct strike. Later, when asked, Lil Dog said that this had been his favorite ride.
John Jeremiah Sullivan, reading an abridged version of his essay, You Blow My Mind, Hey Mickey. Sullivan's a writer and editor and author of a collection of essays called Pulphead. Perhaps no other person in history has influenced theme parks more than Walt Disney. His name is practically synonymous with the modern amusement park, and he was instrumental in reshaping them into the family-friendly spaces we know and love today. Scott Lucas is a cultural anthropologist and former trainer at Six Flags Astro World in Houston, and he's written a book about the evolution of the theme park, from the pleasure gardens of the 19th century to the Disney-inspired parks of today. And he sees theme parks as a kind of liminal space.
I think the liminal space is a good way of looking at it. You can think of that in two senses. I mean, in the sense that Starbucks has been talking about the third place and the idea of a place that's not home or work, it opens up sort of a new sense of space in which people can interact, enjoy themselves, and discover new senses of self. And in terms of that last area, discovering new senses of self, that's the classic idea of liminality in anthropology. It's the notion that you enter a space, you engage in certain rituals, and then you leave that space having been transformed. And so much of what theme parks do and other spaces today, theme spaces like casinos and themed restaurants, there's that focus on saying, we want you to come here, enjoy yourselves, and also be transformed.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking about one of the very first true theme parks, Disneyland, what was Walt Disney's vision?
I think his vision really was to sort of changed the face of public amusements. He had such a successful career in terms of, you know, being an animator and an industry insider, entertainment insider. With his theme parks, I think his vision was to try to collect all the things that he saw in his life growing up in Marceline, Missouri, going to kiddie attractions and seeing, you know, sort of the surly carnival worker and trying to change that and say, well, what could I do? How could I open a theme park that reflects kind of the American character, that draws on my abilities as an animator to create stories, visual or otherwise, in a theme park? And how can I create a space that everybody will enjoy, that will focus on family entertainment, and that will be a place that people remember? And so I think at some level, Disney, whether he said this or not, I think he probably wanted to eventually change society through the theme park. It's something I think we could look to his legacy today and say, indeed, if you look at the media industry that's been transformed by, say, Pirates of the Caribbean, a theme park ride, you could say, indeed, a theme park has transformed who we are, has transformed society itself.
It's interesting that, you know, this first true theme park, Disneyland, was created by a movie maker, you know, Walt Disney, whose job was to tell stories. Because couldn't you say that a theme park is really, at least the parks like Disneyland, it's like an entire fictional world. It's like somebody's created a movie set. You can walk into the movie, but it's all a fiction.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the work I do today, interviewing designers who develop attractions for theme parks and for other consumer spaces, this is the key point, is that you need to focus on effective forms of storytelling. If you move through Pirates of the Caribbean, the famous ride, essentially it's a 3D version of a story. You have everything in there, from exciting characters like Jack Sparrow to plot development. You move through the different vignettes, different scenes. It's remarkable. It all happens in a span of 3 or 4 minutes. And that's what's, I think, truly amazing about this form, is that you can enter a ride and you can get the story in such a short period of time. So I think, indeed, that when you go into a theme park, it's all about telling a story. And the story can happen at different levels. It can happen at the level of a theme land within the theme park, or it could be within one of those attractions.
You know, Walt Disney had this kind of cryptic remark. He said, Disneyland is the reality. What did he mean by that? Or what does that mean to you?
I think if you look at a lot of contemporary philosophers, French philosophers like Jean Baudrillard, who have talked about this, they sort of suggest to us that When you go into a theme park, when you go into a theme space, there's a recreation of some place. And indeed, we see this on the Las Vegas Strip, where we see versions of Paris and different versions of Italy and ancient Rome and so forth. So there's a work of simulation going on, where we take bits of reality and we recreate them for guests in theme parks and in theme casinos. And at some point, I think a lot of these French philosophers pointed out, you would have a situation in which the simulation supplants reality. Walter Benjamin, another theorist, talked about this when he discussed what the effect of technology would be on photography. So if you reproduce something, does the aura, does the sense of the authenticity, the originality of the original disappear? And for a lot of these theorists, the answer is yes. And so when you get the recreated reality of Disneyland, it becomes more real than the real. This is, for me, one of the most interesting aspects of this research, because I think it's a debate that involves so many different points of perspective and trying to understand, what do we mean by a simulation? What's original? What's a copy?
So you mean partly that you visit Disneyland and you walk through this idealized version of small town America, and then you get out and you look at real small town America and you don't want to live there anymore. You want to live in the Disneyland version.
Yeah, I guess in a sense. And that's kind of what happened, with Celebration Florida, which Disney sort of pulled out of. And I read a story on New York Times, and it was talking about Celebration Florida had its first murder. And this was a big deal because, you know, the idea is that you've created this idyllic space and wait, the real is sort of creeping in. It's sort of like, you know, in The Matrix, welcome to the desert of the real. We didn't count on this happening. We're forced to sort of, again, reconcile the relationship between fantasy and the real. So it's quite interesting, I think, when you create idealized versions of reality and then you sort of question, well, what's reality and what's the simulation?
Mm-hmm. Well, today, of course, theme parks have continued to evolve, though I must say, until I read your book, I had no idea quite how bizarre some of them have gotten. There's a really unusual one called Kidzania in Mexico mm-hmm. City. What is Kidzania?
Yeah, Kidzania is an interesting chain that originated in Mexico, and I think there are 10 or so of these small theme parks, and they're going to open up more, and I hear there's one maybe scheduled for the U.S. They're basically miniature theme parks where kids, I think the age range is 2 through 14, they can participate in sort of everyday careers that they might have when they're adults. So there's a section where it's a simulation of a air traffic controller and pilot area, so the kids get to take on the roles. There's another section where they get to work behind a counter of a hamburger joint, and they trade in these currency. They're called kidzos. And as the kids are doing all this, the parents are sort of upstairs behind glass watching all this sort of transpire. I mean, I haven't been to one of these places, but it sounds to me like a sort of a laboratory where you throw your kids in and they're doing all these careers, and then sort of as a parent, you're watching them up above.
Thinking, you look good as an air traffic controller.
Yeah, this could be your future career. The adult supervisors are actually called supervisors, and these are people that sort of give the kids the instructions and tell them what to do and so forth. When I discovered this, I was really kind of blown away because it just sounded like something you would read about in a novel or in some futuristic, you know, movie about theme parks.
Well, there's a slightly sinister side to it also. You uncovered there's a lot of corporate branding that goes on.
Oh, yeah, there's a ton of it. I mean, so hospitals could be sponsored by Johnson & Johnson. And I think in some of them, you know, the burger joint is a simulation of a simulation of a McDonald's. And so I think it's one of these tricky places where you think about there is a value for kids to learn skills. They can learn teamwork skills. They could develop their creativity. But then the sort of downside of this is you have all these corporate messages and branding that is being used. And then adults and corporations essentially are giving kids directives on what to do. And it's kind of like the classic thing when you have a young kid who's working on some art project. And if the adult starts to dictate, well, you have to do your lines this way and your perspective should be done this way, in a sense, you're quelling that creativity. And I think it's the same thing. I think the intentions are good as far as kids developing important skills. But then is it good that branding and products and corporations are sort of the ones dictating this and instilling in kids the values of corporations and branding? And that's, I think, the side of it that concerns me the most.
Mm. And so this is back to the theme of the theme park as a form of social engineering.
Yeah, and now I think it's full-fledged with the brand. You know, you could read Naomi Klein and hear a lot about this, where it's sort of like our most intimate values, our everyday lives, are being dictated by brands. And again, if you get it in a theme park, because it's immersive, because it's multi-sensory and multi-experiential, I would argue that's going to have a deeper effect on you versus just, you know, seeing an ad in print media where it's like, oh, okay, this is an ad for Nike or Budweiser and it's telling me how to be. But if you experience that, particularly as a kid, in an immersive space, I think the effect is going to be double or triple or even more than that.
Hmm. Well, and I guess the very concept of theme park, even that phrase, by now has become a metaphor that's seeping into many different parts of our culture. The idea of the theme park is finding its way into political discussions. Haven't there been critics who've charged that the U.S. invasion of Iraq has produced a terrorist Disneyland?
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this, I think when a theme park gets used in political discourse, when it gets used in popular culture and isn't referring to the actual theme park space, I think people are focusing kind of to the negative connotation. And we see sort of in an exercise here in semiotics that people are very suspicious of theme parks. The connotation seems to be something like it's a fantasy space, it's escapist, it's non-intellectual, it's a place where you sort of get a whitewashed version of reality or of society. So when we use it in political discourse, I think we realize that people do have this connotation like, well, if it's a theme park, it's not serious, it's escapist. So therefore, we apply it to our political enemies or to situations like the war in Iraq that we don't find very palatable because we want to sort of draw on that negativity that's associated with the theme park. And I think that's another interesting reflection on the earlier discussion about authenticity and the idea that a theme park, you know, inherently isn't authentic, so we can apply it then as a metaphor to focus on other situations that seem to be inauthentic or politically challenging or whatever.
That's Scott Lucas. He's the author of Theme Park. Hey, if you like what you heard this hour, why not subscribe to our podcast? Just look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. And while you're there, leave us a review. That helps other people find the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tangekar produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Joe Hartke filled in today. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.